Welcome to Grimshaw Speakers, a partnership between the Grimshaw Club and the Beaver Sound. We bring you conversations with exceptional individuals discussing the issues of our times. We spoke with Dr. Hugo Slim, head of policy at the ICRC, about war and humanitarian action. Enjoy.
So I'm Henry Adichie, I work at LSE on humanitarianism and conflicts as part of the conflict research programme. And it's wonderful to welcome Hugo here. I think if humanitarianism was a religion, then the ICRC would be its high priesthood. And I think you're probably better qualified than most for the role of high priest, as you, I think, did your first degree in theology, is that right? But Hugo also has extensive secular qualifications. He's had a really fascinating career crisscrossing humanitarianism and practice. I won't say too much because I think he's going to say a little bit about his trajectory from where many of you are now to where this kind of position in a second. But I think what's interesting about your trajectory is it sort of covers two big shifts that are of particular interest to us. One is the development of humanitarianism from a sort of lo-fi, swashbuckling, garage startup type endeavour in the early 80s and to today's highly professionalised multi-billion dollar industry. And so I suppose your career is sort of mapped onto that development. And then the other thing, sort of closer to home in academia, is I suppose possibly as a result of this history, there's been a whole new field of study around the humanitarian enterprise and what does it mean, what are the practical, political and ethical questions it throws up. And it's in that area that I've encountered Hugo's work, particularly his writings on humanitarian ethics. But I looked up, so I'd have the number to hand, how many of your pieces of writing I had in my EndNote reference library, which you should all use when you're writing your dissertations. Get your references neatly arranged to save time at the very end of the process. And I've saved, I think, 24 articles, books and blogs of yours. So very influential, and I think particularly influential are your two recent books, the 2007 book on killing civilians and the 2015 book on humanitarian ethics, which I have somewhere here. It's my prop. It's my only prop. Available in all good bookshops. I recommend it. And I think both are, in a way, should be the first port of call for anyone wanting to learn more about those issues. And I suppose the sort of poles between the killing that goes on and the ethics that we need to respond to are the two most visceral considerations, well, two most vital considerations, rather, perhaps, that humanitarians face on a daily basis. Anyway, I'll stop there, and I've asked Hugo to say a few words about how his career trajectory has developed, sort of from his student days as a theologian to what seems to his last weeks of being the high priest of the ICRC. And hopefully that will inspire you if you're looking to make your mark in this area. Hopefully on the mitigating war side of things rather than perpetuating war side of things. I realise we're at LSE, so both options are open to you and have been exercised in the past, but we very much hope on the mitigation side. So hand over to Hugo and to say a few words about what it's felt like navigating this space from the inside.
I will. Henry, thank you so much for such a generous introduction, and it's lovely to be here. It's lovely to be at LSE, because I've only really been here once or twice before. I examined a very earnest PhD here years ago, and then I do remember giving a talk here. But I think some of you have been taught by David Keane, probably, and I'm of his sort of generation. How should I start? We're going to show a little film about the ICRC in a minute, but I'll start, you know, telling you a little about where I started. So as Henry says, I'm a theologian. As a young person, I had a sort of spiritual temper, I suppose, a sort of slightly religious and mystical and ethical mind. And when I was at school in the 70s, in a way, the best place to interrogate that, I found, was through theology. So I became one of three theologians at my school doing A-level theology. And I found it very rewarding, and so I kind of went and did it at university. And if I sort of explain my career trajectory, I'll probably do it in a very politically incorrect way. But I came from, a big part of my family was a British imperial family, it was an empire family. So both my grandfathers had made their name and their fortune out in the East, one in the Indian Army and the other as a merchant across the Middle East. And so that was part of my family. And the other part, there were quite a lot of priests in it. So there were sort of, Scottish ministers and Anglican priests and that sort of thing. And I retrospectively explained that career move when I was, 20, 21, at the end of university, trying to work out what to do. I tried to find a way to sort of reconcile this militant, militaristic, imperial part of my genetic inheritance with this more theological, religious, ethical, compassionate part. And the answer was NGOs. So at that time, I thought, gosh, you can go and be a sort of imperialist, and you can go to Africa and Asia and all these places, but be nice and get sort of brownie points for it. And so that's what I did. And I thought, I can go there and I don't have to be a soldier. I don't have to do this. I can go do it in a good cause. And, I think if we take the point that, in a way, the humanitarian profession today, the development profession, is really the long tail of empire still. Think in many ways, culturally, and the way it operates, it seems always deeply colonial to me in many ways, in the way it's structured, the way it talks about others, and the way it sees its own responsibilities as almost a sort of civilizational mitigating responsibility in all that way. I think that's where I found myself, and then I went through a little journey. I suppose as a young person, I very much had been influenced when I was probably about seven by the Biafran War, the Nigerian Civil War. And one of my earliest memories is sitting there with my boiled egg for tea, watching something that's very iconic to British people called Blue Peter, which was a sort of information program for young people in black and white. And the first time that these famines were really televised on a regular daily basis, because you could fly the reel back overnight to London and play it, was the Biafran War. And I remember sitting there watching this, and I saw lots of African people starving and suffering, and I saw these sort of white figures moving through it with this sort of thing on them, okay, and that sort of thing. And I felt, that's what I want to do. And I think that was my do something moment. And I think a lot of us have a do something moment at some point in my life, in our lives. And of course, that do something moment then meant that when I left university, all my friends were trying to join investment banks and be a barrister or join the BBC or join the Foreign Office. And I was writing these rather pathetic letters to Oxfam and Christian Aid and Save the Children people. Save the Children eventually answered and said, yeah, we've got a volunteer position in Morocco, why don't you try that? I had a little interview, went off, and I had a really interesting year. Which I think is very important for everybody to have who's interested in working with people. I had a working with disabled children in Morocco for a year, very close up in a little institution, which would be considered very, again, politically incorrect today, probably. But it was a really important year for me to work closely with people, with children. And it's, I think, my experience of understanding and living within a disabled community has stayed with me always and has really helped me see the disability issue. And disability rights are perhaps one of the most radical areas of development always, and they've been very influential. So I did that, and then I still hadn't quite got my do something moment out of my system. And then the Ethiopian famine started, and I was then deployed into what you would today call a humanitarian setting. We didn't use that word then. We talked about being a relief worker, because we were still in an Anglo-Saxon paradigm of sort of relief and development and that sort of thing. We hadn't bought into the French-Swiss idea of humanitarianism. And then I became a humanitarian worker, working as I had seen those people working in Biafra, in a really tragic and terrible refugee camp on the border of Sudan and Ethiopia, with lots of Tigrayans starving to death. When I arrived, we were probably having a death rate of about 100 people a day, and we were really in, you said, garage startup. We were really trying to do a startup in some way to save those people's lives. And I did that, and I found myself living that life, and I thought, oh, I've arrived, and I've got a white Land Rover, and I've got the emblem, and I am wandering around and ministering to widows and orphans. And I think I would summarise that as my dysfunctional white knight phase, as in chivalrous white knight, because I really thought I was the person doing all the good. And I lived in that moment of vocation probably for a couple of years in the Ethiopian, maybe 3 years in the Ethiopian Sudanese famine at that point. We're now in sort of 85, 88. None of you are born yet, I don't suppose. And then I came back after that, and people always used to say to me, oh, you're doing wonderful work. We had a joke at Save the Children that everyone would say, you're doing wonderful work. But then I began, I suppose, to be a bit more LSE-ish, and I began to engage with Oxfam and with liberation theology. So I started reading liberation theology coming out of the sort of Marxist tradition of radical Catholicism in Central America, South America, Brazil, and places. And that was my sort of politicization moment. And really, from then, I realized that this whole profession, at its best, and if it was to be truly ethical, should be one of solidarity. And it should have not the grammar of I help them, but they survive and I try and work with them in some way. So that grammar change was very important to me, that syntactic change. And that's where I suppose I've been ever since, trying to work more with a solidarist method and not have a narcissistic, egocentric approach to humanitarian action. It's very difficult because the profession has grown so big and because it is so obviously a sort of post-colonial tale, as I mentioned, in itself. My final phase, because my son's just walking at the back of the room, my final phase is when I then had children and when I then went and saw another terrible refugee camp a bit later on in my life as a father and as a parent. You don't just have a political moment then, you have a very different moment, which is your sort of parental phase where you think, oh my God, I absolutely understand what that man and that woman are going through, because they really don't know if their child will be alive tomorrow, and if they have the agency and the ability in this situation of displacement, of distress, actually to keep their children alive. And that's a very shocking and moving thing to feel. And that's important too, to integrate into your humanitarian call, if you like, your humanitarian vocation. So that was the early bit. I'm probably banging on too long, but I'm very old. It's a long time. And then I suppose I became an academic, and Henry's absolutely right. There was this moment in the sort of early 90s, you know, when humanitarian action, international humanitarian action, went from being a cottage industry, where we were all really amateurs, very gifted, really interesting entrepreneurial people, making a lot of discoveries about nutrition, water, health in extreme situations. A lot of it leveraged out of knowledge from the Holocaust and starvation after Belsen and that sort of thing. Then there was this huge growth. And so with the Cold War ending, a lot of wars started. And the Russians and the Americans didn't really want to keep people out. So then there was a whole new space for humanitarian workers to get into the middle of these war zones. That happened. Governments funded it. There was a sort of unique moment of global consensus at the Security Council. And extraordinarily, from sort of 1990, when probably the global budget for humanitarian action from Western donors, because it remains a Western project largely, went from $5 billion rocketing up to the $29 billion it is today. Now, during that growth, one of the things we did, I felt one of the things I could usefully do was to provide people with the education that I had never had, but should have had. So I worked with a guy called Nabil Hamdi in Oxford to start a master's program at Oxford Brookes for humanitarian workers working on conflict, humanitarian action development. And our commitment there was really to ground and shape a practice which was internationally politically informed, so you were politically savvy people as humanitarian workers. You understood the law, refugee law, humanitarian law, human rights law, and your practice was essentially community-orientated, more developmental practice than dirigiste, impositional practice. So that's what I did, and then I've sort of flip-flopped in and out of work, and when my children came to university, I thought, God, I can now leave university. So maybe I should go back to an operational agency and challenge myself with a midlife challenge. And that's what I did at the ICRC and became head of policy 5 years ago. And then went into a major bureaucracy. Now $2 billion a year, 20,000 people around the world, 1,000 people at headquarters. And as you say, that was very different to the cottage industry in which I started. Does that say a little bit about where
Absolutely.
I come from?
Actually, I'm going to go. Do you mind if I just go off script and ask something a little bit before we get into what war looks like today?
Yeah.
Just say, ask something about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think a couple of things that were interesting about that is if you read an IR textbook about conflict or war, and then the Red Cross comes up, I think it seems like it's very narrow, the residue of the sort of real politics that's going on. But I think what's interesting about this is the way it shows all of life, in a way, being dealt with through these interactions. And I wonder if you could say a bit about that. And also the first thing they said in the intro is something that I've picked up in your work in a couple of places, I think, which is the idea of love as a sort of grounding. That's a difficult thing to pin down what you think the role of that is. But again, that's something that goes beyond the kind of abstracted idea of what the Red Cross is and might be in an interesting way.
I'll try. So that's politics and love. So on the politics front, I think you're right. You know, I think the ICRC, you know, we've been going for a long time now, 157 years this week, actually. And we do get involved in all parts of life. Because armed conflict, because war, because violence, when it's really organised at that level, does affect all aspects of life. So you will find us doing water. You will find us doing prisons. You will find us doing, some of you understood the French there, campaigning to, you know, reduce sexual violence in armed conflict. So that's a tough social, cultural issue to engage on. You'll find us trying to reunite families, so working as social workers. You'll find us trying to reduce and limit the kind of weapons used in war. So we are in all aspects of life. And the other thing that's striking today is because so many conflicts are so long, we are in places for many, many years. We did a report about 3 years ago on protracted conflict, and we worked out that of our top 10 conflicts, the big Syrias, well, Afghanistan, DRC, Iraq, all these long ones, obviously Israel, Palestine. We've been in those conflicts continuously for an average of 36 years. So not only are we involved in all parts of life, but we're very much known by all parts of the community. The way we, as the International Committee of the Red Cross, the most neutral armed conflict bit, work is to work with all parties. And we're entitled and required under international law to work with all parties. So we do literally know everyone politically, and we have done for decades, and we are often engaged in many parts of life. But the difference there is our teleology, if you like. I'm at LSE, so I can use Greek words. We're not about creating the ideal society. We're not about having a political project that says, you know, the best society is an Islamist society, a communist society, a capitalist society, a liberal society. We are just working on this very limited ethic of protecting human life. And so that comes to your second point, Henry, which is, I was amazed when I got to ICRC and saw this film for the first time and saw them using the word love. Because I struggled quite a lot in secular, largely liberal, leftist academia to use the word love. But I decided to in that book. And in a way, love is probably one of the best ways to describe, one of the oldest ways to describe, the principle of humanity, which is the principle that drives the Red Cross, Red Crescent movement. And that principle is simply to protect life and health and to ensure respect for the human being. And if you've read Eric Fromm, does anyone read Eric Fromm anymore from the Frankfurt School? You know, he did a great book on love, I don't know, in the 50s or 60s, I don't know when it was. And he takes a very broad definition of love, which is not, he's actually writing about sort of against the stereotyping of love as romantic love. So he has a very broad definition of love. And that would probably fit in, you know, to respect life and health and ensure respect for the human being. And that's really our mission. And I always say that if you tap any Red Cross, Red Crescent worker on the shoulder, you know, the surgeon you saw there, the war surgeon, the social worker type person loading children onto planes to reunite them with their families, if you tap me on the shoulder in my suit in the UN or whatever as a Red Cross diplomat, and you say, what are you doing? We should only ever just turn around quickly and say, we're trying to protect life and health and ensure respect for the human being. That's all we're ever trying to do. So we're in all parts of politics, in all parts of society, but with this very limited ethic of, perhaps, love.
Thanks. So maybe we'll go back to where I said we'd start, actually, which is the landscape of violence today. Because again, I think to complicate the picture from what you might read if you're looking at it top down through the lens of great power politics or whatever, presumably in the places, these contexts of protracted conflict, actually the relationship between war, conflict and violence is constantly reshaping and changing, both at very local levels and at the big picture level.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you could say a bit about how that's evolving now and maybe the next, where you see it going over the next decade or so.
I will, and your first point's really key. I think when we talk about protracted conflicts, and we talk about a protracted conflict in Iraq or Afghanistan, whatever, even Syria now, CAR, we're wrong to put that conflict in the singular. Because although the conflict in Afghanistan may be going for 40 years, or Iraq now for so long, it's not one conflict. It's like serial conflict. So you're absolutely right. So the conflicts change all the time. And we're talking about many, many different conflicts evolving over time. So of course, when we first went into Afghanistan with the Russian invasion in 79, that was a very different conflict to the conflicts today in Afghanistan. And there have been probably, you know, about 6, 7, 8 different major reorientations of those conflicts. So the first point is that, you know, the conflict is usually conflicts over time and conflicts over space. So there are, you know, if you look at Syria today, if you look at, CAR, DRC, if you look across into the Sahel, which is another big conflict system at the moment, across, you know, from Niger, Burkina Faso, across to Nigeria, there are conflicts within conflicts all the time, and they mutate and change, and the actors change. So that's a very important point. I think the second thing, if I was to describe the landscape today, the other thing I would probably say is that there are, and I'm going to be simplistic, but maybe we could talk about three different major types of context. And the first would be those sort of civil war conflicts that I've just described, which change over time between contests within a state, which are internationalized by UN forces or Western, non-Western sponsors and proxies over time, and they sort of evolve. And there's many of those. There's also those conflicts which, and so there's a often talked about as non-international armed conflicts, what we would have called civil wars in the vernacular. But they're often internationalized, so they're often actually, and we, if you look at the Geneva Conventions, you can look at a place like Syria and look at about, and you can define legally, there are probably 20 different wars in Syria at the moment between different parties. I think the second thing, of course, that we still have is that jihadist global insurgency, which is continuing around the world and moving from place to place. So many of those wars, I'm not sure of the statistics, but probably sort of 45-50% of those wars have a strong jihadist Islamist element to them. So that is one of the key parts of the conflict landscape today. And it's shifting heavily over to the Sahel now, out of the Middle East. The big one that we're on the cusp of now, which the ICRC is increasingly concerned about, is if you read the US security military doctrine of 2017 and then the Chinese response to that the year after, you will realize that, I mean, in the US doctrine it says very clearly the 20 years of the war on terror are now over. We recognize that, you know, jihadist terrorism will continue, but it's a sort of real subplot. Today, the big strategic picture is peer-to-peer conflict. So it's going back to great power contestation of the 19th century, 20th century. And US military doctrine, security doctrine, Chinese, Russian, NATO, British, French is now gearing up again for what they're calling peer-to-peer conflict. That means equals, as in peer, not a Frenchman, but peer, equal conflicts. And that's going to involve this huge shift from what's really been called counterinsurgency, insurgency, counterinsurgency, hearts and minds, war on terror, back to, in a sense, I always say, it's, you know, welcome back to real war, high intensity conflict. So in the jargon, it's going from COIN, counterinsurgency, to HIC, high intensity conflict. And what we're seeing there now is a massive implication, because if you look at the US security doctrine now, military doctrine, they're now accepting the reality and the use of low-yield nuclear weapons as part of their tactical strategic framework for high-intensity conflict. They announced 2 weeks ago that landmines were back in, okay, and cluster bombs. So your generation, I'm afraid, now is going to move back into what I grew up with, which is major power contestation with major weapons. And all the sort of care and discussion of the Geneva Conventions we've had in the counterinsurgency war on terror phase, where it was in the interest of great powers to be seen to be nice to populations, that will go out of the window. And their calculations of civilian protection, the ratios, the importance of that will change dramatically, because they will be looking to win against an adversary who is going to hurt them a lot. So they're going to take a lot of losses, so they're going to accept a lot of losses to win. And is that sort of the three? One other one, urban violence. You know, the ICRC, it took the war in Syria something like 4 years to catch up with the death rates in Mexico from urban violence, gang violence, femicide. You know, I think a lot of you are women in the room. I think that's a good term. I think it's a very descriptive term of a lot of urban violence, that it's the deliberate killing of women as message sending and power play in urban violence, gang violence. Is this rain? So I think urban violence is another big terrain. We at the ICRC really want to work more in urban violence, because in a way that may be the future. You know, you're right to describe it as not quite peace, not quite war, a lot of these situations, and that's a classic example.
What would you say about the tension between a sort of pattern of conflicts maybe coming down the line, which is where great powers are fighting wars to win, versus one of the dynamics that some people say is going on in these protracted conflicts, is that actually that's not really the goal. They're what you put it nicely when you said conflict systems. Mm. The end game may not be to win. It may be a system in which different actors have interests in continuing.
Well, I think that will go on, I think. I think there's some actors in wars who don't want to win. They don't want victory because they can't really secure it, so it actually plays to their advantage to keep destabilizing, so they keep holding territory, they keep controlling war economies, all your David Keane stuff, and black market stuff. So it's in their interest to keep the war going. And David's written very evidentially and clearly about that. But I think there was another decision, you know, probably from Western powers, that these were wars they couldn't win. Because to win them would mean to do it empire style from the 19th century, just to conquer that land and take 30 years to pacify, subject it, whatever. And they weren't going to do that. So I think some of it they want to win and others can't win.
And what about the... how do you think the broader shifts in international power politics are going to affect this?
I don't know.
If it's the case that we're moving to a post-liberal international order.
It's very interesting. Whenever we talk to the Chinese and we try and find connection with the Chinese government, who we work with a lot in Beijing and in New York at the UN, you know, they always quite rightly point out to us, we don't need to deal with you that much because we are the only P5 state who is not at war. all the other P4, you know, Russia, France, Britain, America, are chronically at war. They are the most belligerent nations in the international community. And, you know, China's right to say we're not at war. We don't do war. We don't want to do war. You don't see us using it as policy internationally. And that's true. And the question is how long that will remain true and how they will be able to continue with that line when it's clear they are building up huge forces. And, you know, if you look at the statistics, the scale of growth in the Chinese Navy, in Chinese military capacity, in their, you know, brilliance with sort of digital cyber and increasingly outer space war, you know, what will happen with all that? What happens when you have all that stuff eventually? And if you've got people feeling threatened by you, what's going to happen? So it's hard to say. I mean, the other thing to say internationally about the political system, the political world at the moment, is that, again, if we look at my little career, the period of time, one of the things that's very exciting internationally is that we now can talk about multipolar politics. So we can say that there are many different nodes of power across the international, across international society, and all those states which were really trying and struggling to emerge from subjection, colonial rule, imperialism in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, a lot of them really do have significant wealth and power now and full capacity for running a foreign policy and engaging in politics. So one of our big challenges as the ICRC in the last 5-10 years, and will go on being, has been to really get to know and engage states like, you know, Indonesia, Nigeria, Kenya, South Africa, Brazil, Mexico, Iran, all these states that now are really significant in at the UN in policy terms and in their capability. So that's changed things.
So in a way, that could be a healthy development.
I hope so.
Sounds like so it could be in if you. The part of the story that's about what you call the tail end of imperialism, is it this multipolar order that will force humanity?
I hope so. Yeah, and that's great. And it's really happening. I mean, if you go to, I've spent the last 3 or 4 years working hard, sort of trying to shape our relationship with ASEAN, which is the Association of Southeast Asian States. So the 15 states, you know, Indonesia, Myanmar, Vietnam, Thailand, Malaysia, Singapore, all these ones. And they're very clear that they don't want a humanitarian invasion from the West. So they're going to structure their own world, and they're basically saying, we don't want this colonial imperial tale where you all think you can turn up and, you know, in this expeditionary humanitarian mode, as we call it. And they're the ones pushing localization. So they're saying, right, no international invasion here. We will run any response to earthquakes, floods, cyclones, and armed conflict. And I think that's right, because I think that's how we would want it in the UK. I don't think we'd want to be invaded if we didn't have to by lots of people from MSF France. And
actually, at the moment, I'm not so sure.
That's true, yes. But, and so they're really saying, no, there are going to be limits to the way you guys do this. And so we've had to negotiate over the last 4 years a way that we work with them so that we provide complementary advice, and that in a conflict like Rakhine in Myanmar, it is accepted that because of our Geneva Convention role, we will work on the ground in our neutral, impartial way. But that's been a very important moment for us, because that's them then recognizing, okay, the ICRC can work when there's a conflict here, but we still want to somehow make sure they don't become the beginning of a mass invasion.
And if you want, if we were to broaden that, so what you think the challenges of for humanitarian actors in terms of adapting to the world as it is today and is likely to be tomorrow? So that's the diplomatic picture.
Yeah.
What are the sort of big work streams that you think the sector has to adjust its ways of working while staying true to its headline values and principles?
Well, I think there's two things. I think that I often talk about the sort of elaboration of humanitarian action. And I think, you know, if we look at how humanitarians work, you know, we started, and when I started, it was largely, as you saw, sort of food, water, shelter, and sort of minimal protection, trying to make sure people weren't attacked wrongly or whatever. I think it's become a very elaborate sort of social science now, humanitarian action. So it's taken on all the obligatory requirements of good Western social science: gender, diversity, inclusion, disability, health is mental health as well as physical health, ideas of resilience, sustainability. These are sort of considered good, positive values in sort of Western welfareism and Western ideologies of development that you all study. And they are now sort of demands put upon humanitarian action by humanitarians themselves. But that makes it very, very difficult, actually. To be a brilliant social worker while you're working in these situations is not easy. So there's the elaboration of the field of practice that's very difficult. The second big area is the business model. Because, you know, as I just described in ASEAN, if states are quite rightly, you know, going to say we don't want this expeditionary humanitarian thing where lots of young people from Europe with European money come out and feel they're right there to have to intervene in our states, then that's a major business model change. Because at the moment, the $29 billion per year of humanitarian aid from primarily Western governments is based on an expeditionary model, that you have this tight core, the money comes from the West, the large sort of oligopoly of big agencies, Red Cross, UN, CARE, Save the Children, Oxfam, that's the first point of channels. Those are like the big funds, if you like, and it spreads out from there. And I think that business model will be challenged. And I think it's going to be challenged because the money is about to plateau. You know, it's gone from 5 billion, as I said, up to 29 billion. It's probably going to start plateauing now, and then it might dip, because I think a lot of the more perhaps nationalist, I would expect President Trump perhaps, and if he gets a second term, I would expect him probably to set about the UN a bit and say, right, we're cutting that, because they do pay for most of it. And I think that will start dipping. And they've got to change the business model at that point. So I think a lot of jobs will go, and they will have to embrace a localization agenda, a different way of working, because the empire will be over, in a sense.
It's really interesting. I'm going to ask one more question before opening it up, and then so maybe think about what you would like to ask, Hugo, yeah. And then I've got a few more that I can tag on later on. Within this, you have a very specific position and a very, very specific organisation, which has, as you said, it's mandated by the law in particular ways. It's not the case for Oxfam or the humanitarian bits of Oxfam or MSF. So what do you think the ICRC's challenge in the next few years is? How should it try and adapt to the...
Well, I do think you're right. I do think our mandate is unique, and it is, you know, we're an anomaly in international relations, because we are a private Swiss organisation recognised in international law and therefore mandated by states, and we are part of the diplomatic community. You know, so we are permanent observers of the UN and ASEAN and everywhere else. I think the challenge for us is to handle the growth we've been through. So we're now a $2 billion organisation, 20,000 people. That's been a growth spurt. What are we going to how are we going to manage that, consolidate it? How are we going to actually rationalise that business model? I think the other big challenge is, how are we going to convince all those newly powerful states, like the Indonesias of the world, the Chinas of the world, the Indias of the world, that we are different and legitimate and distinct, and that if they have a war and if there are wars nearby, they should recognise our unique role and use us. That will be a challenge, because it's very hard not to be seen as part of that Western invasion. And that distinguishing ourselves from that is a permanent job. We must go on doing that so that we're recognised as different somehow. And then I think our concern is, if we go into that high intensity conflict era that I said, that the levels of casualty the levels of destruction across the world, if there is a sort of World War III scenario, will put huge strain on us. And the only way we're going to be able to achieve any kind of impact is by being a movement. So working with all our national societies, we've got someone from the Italian Red Cross in the front row. You know, we need therefore to work with the Syrian Red Crescent, the Italian Red Cross, the Yemeni Red Crescent, everybody. We'd have to leverage the whole of the 193 societies much better than we do at the moment. Because we're a bit about us at the ICRC in the last few years as we've grown. We're going to have to be a lot more about the whole movement if war becomes truly catastrophic in the next few years.
I suppose over the last 157 years, the Red Cross looks recognisable, but actually developments and conflict over that period have been absolutely extraordinary. Yeah,
they have.
And we've been in scale and type.
And I think the other, I mean, in your IR jargon, we are, I think, a serial norm entrepreneur. You know, we discovered the wounded in war, we created international conventions, practices around that. We discovered prisoners of war, we did the same there, then civilians, and then we went on to weapons, you know, alongside others. Our challenge in the next generation will be outer space, cyber, new tech weapons. What does it mean to bring ethical and legal normative control to these new weapons? What does it mean if actually they're not weapons anymore, but they're non-human combatants? So they're making their own minds up. They're charging into a room now and deciding who to kill and whatever in a very autonomous way. These are huge challenges of ethics and norms and practice that we've got to keep pace with. So in a way, I'm about to write a book this year for the Red Cross Red Crescent movement about the battlefields today. And of course, it's not a battlefield. It goes from outer space to through, you know, air, sea, land, cyber, digital, whatever, to the individual on the ground. And it's a huge amount of battle spaces that's our challenge.
Great, thank you. Let's have a few questions from the floor.
First of all, thank you very much. It's really, really interesting. I've got just two questions that I wanted to ask. One's quite general and one's a bit more specific. The first one, we had, I don't know whether you might know Diana Melrose by any chance.
Yeah.
So we had her a couple of months ago speak to us about the many things that she's done in her career, one of which, Oxfam and Save the Children. And what came up was a discussion about, obviously, the recent difficulties and scandals that have hit both Oxfam and Save the Children and the ICRC as well. So what I wanted to ask was, kind of going back to when you were describing your progression and your career path and your decision to go back to kind of train up humanitarians and how to kind of, you know, have a proper training for those going into the field. How is this going to change, and what kind of challenges is, how is this going to change with the recent scandals which have come to light? How is the ICRC dealing with that? And then the other question I wanted to bring in as well was something really interesting from the video was the role that translators have at the ICRC. I know of someone who's currently in Gaza, being as an Arabic translator there, and it struck me as, you know, you've described in great clarity, with great clarity, the role that the ICRC does and how someone working for them should describe what they are doing at any moment. But that's kind of quite a different, strikes me as a kind of a different action in terms of providing potentially oversight or some, you know, a role which I would say is similar to one that Amnesty International holds. So that's really three questions, I'm sorry. But if you could kind of respond to those, that'd be really interesting.
Should I take them one at a time? Yeah, I think they are three questions, but they're sort of about the same thing.
Yes.
And I think they're about, you know, what does it mean to change and become a 2020s humanitarian organisation? And I think it will mean a lot more of partnership. And so realising it's not going to be you mounting an expedition to do everything. Mm-hmm. It's going to be you working with partners who are already there. And, of course, that's not a new thing. That happened that Oxfam was set up to do just that, but it then became more expeditionary. Actually. So I think that, in terms of the skills for the 2020s humanitarian workers, it's really about, you know, in the words of the HBG report, letting go. And actually not saying I have to do this, but how do I help people on the ground create organisations that do it? So it's more of a partnership skill, a capacity building skill set, all the stuff you're familiar with in development theory. Australian Red Cross is probably the boldest in our movement for trying to do that, because they experienced from Southeast Asia and the Pacific, they got the finger, you know, get out, we don't want you Aussies turning up and doing everything on Ulstep, work out how to help us. So they have undergone a process where they completely changed their business model to a partnership model to support locally led humanitarian action.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's a different skill set, it's a different kind of people, and that's what it'll take. In terms of the Oxfam and, say, the children's scandals, I think, you know, we've had our sort of bankers moment, we've had our sort of Hollywood Me Too moment and things, and I'm sure that's right. And I hope it means real change in organisations. It's partly also, of course, the great progress of feminism, which is now has a critical mass to say clearly that these things are intolerable, unacceptable, unethical, and have to stop. So that has reached the sector very effectively. What we're doing at the ICRC, because, you know, we have, like everyone, we have a lot of baggage there. We have problems that we've never addressed properly. We've been able to say, you know, well, we're charging around the world, it's a difficult job, you know, things happen. We don't look at some behaviours, we tolerate others. If somebody's does something, well, we might not necessarily sack them, we'll move them. And we've now really changed that very seriously. So, you know, as of last year, we've built up a major new compliance part of the organisation. And, you know, with a sort of zero tolerance thing and very detailed procedures. And I'm afraid, you know, we have hundreds of cases now. You know, from a staff of 20,000, we probably have, I think when I last spoke to there's a nice Swedish woman we got in from Novartis, the drug company, to head our compliance office. And when I last spoke to her, she said we have about 600 cases at the moment, you know, up for whatever. Now, the majority of those are actually bullying and harassment. They're not the sort of sexual. The sexual ones seem to be a minority. They're either sort of fraudish or just bad boss, you know, bullying bad bosses, which is in a sense the biggest area. So that's how we're trying to change it. And it means people leave.
So you have a very you have a very interesting career, but as was said, it was in a very specific context, and that has really evolved over the years. And I was wondering what you would say or advise to someone who would be interested in having this sort of career that mixes academics and hopefully eye level practitioner.
Yeah. So, someone now of your
yeah.
age. I think I'd probably say, you know, there's a core, and I would say this obviously, there's a core of organisations like the ICRC, like parts of the UN system, that we need as part of international order and accepted political norms that need to keep going. So, you know, you should always think about joining those. But I think I would ask you all to find ways to challenge the business model, to challenge the $29 billion industry and say it's not sustainable, it's patronising, it has a colonial imperial tail to it. How can we form new models of organisation, much more perhaps solidarist based, that play to all your strengths as a young generation that understands tech, horizontal, you know, contact over great areas, digital space, whatever, and come up with new models of organisation, come up with new ways of helping people who are suffering in war and disaster, and you know, deliberately challenge this point in the organisational life cycle that we've got to, that Henry described so well at the beginning, and see different ways of doing it. So I would be a bit revolutionary about it. I mean, take down some structures, prove there are different ways of doing it, and don't automatically buy into what a big bureaucracy is. I did a blog a month ago about reflections of a humanitarian bureaucrat, where I sort of traced that history a bit. You know, challenge those things a bit. Start other things, do other things. Take a position that we're not going to rush around and charge about and be helpers and saviours. We're going to find new ways of helping people to survive within a conflict somehow.
Thank you again for the very interesting speech. My question is a little bit more technical. So having had all those very diverse experiences throughout the 80s, 90s up to this point, have, within ICRC, have you felt a change within the approach to the actual delivery of aid and relief in very hostile environments where governments or very successful war entrepreneurs operating within very successful war economies are building, continuously building barriers or imposing conditions that ethically could be challenged from the like standpoint of humanitarian action. So have there been any developments in ways to think about it and ways to deal with that?
Yeah. It's a really good question as well. I think in some ways it hasn't changed much at all. You know, whenever you are in a war and you're trying to argue for humanitarian action, for the protection of certain groups, for the delivery of certain life-saving items and services, you always meet people who don't want that to happen. Or who, if they want it to happen, they want to manipulate it and lean it into their interests. So that happens in every war. And, you know, the ICRC has no magic key to this. You know, we can probably get access where some people can't, but we spend a lot of time being blocked as well. So that basic problem remains the same. There are, in a sense, some potentially leapfrog technologies that really help that. I mean, the one really most dramatic innovation over my lifetime, apart from that sort of gender one, the sort of feminist one that's taken place, is cash, actually. So, you know, when I was starting out, people were doing cash in development. They were doing sort of giving people cash and saying you can spend it on that to send your children to school, whatever, whatever. But that was revolutionized with digital technology. And so sometimes the ability to give people cash through their telephones or through cards means you can reach them without having to go to them. So you can leapfrog certain obstacles. I think that's probably one way it's changed. I mean, anyone else think of ways that those old access and political obstruction problems have changed? I think a lot of them are still the same. Another way it changes, you know, if I look at one major way our work's changed technically in the ICRC in the last 10 years, because a lot of wars began to take place in middle-income, Middle Eastern countries, these were really quite rich, very well organized, sophisticated states with infrastructure, a lot of development infrastructure, water, health treatment going to, you know, chronic diseases like kidney dialysis, diabetes, heart disease treatment, all this sort of stuff. We've had to make a massive turn into major infrastructure. So a lot of our work across the Middle East is actually keeping major urban water, electricity, health infrastructure going. And if we can do that, then it means we may never meet people, but we're still keeping the lights on for them, still keeping water flowing to them, and that may be another way we can get past sort of checkpoints, if you like. Does that answer at all?
Yeah, along those lines, yeah.
Okay.
Because it's a very complicated question, isn't it?
It is,
There's no straightforward answer.
No, and so you know, you're always going to have political obstruction.
Yeah.
And can you find that sort of magic fungible aid that runs like water through political obstruction? Not easily, is the answer.
Yeah, I've got a couple of questions there, and then you.
So thank you for your talk, first of all. And I have two questions that are a bit related to the previous one, actually. The first one is, you talked about conflicts within conflicts in the Sahel region, for example.
Yeah.
And I was wondering what the ICRC's policy is towards engaging with non-governmental groups, for example, to negotiate access to specific areas. And my second question is, because you're funded by a lot of Western governments, I know that the US and the UK governments have restrictions on funds they give in terrorist-prone areas or with groups that are considered as terrorists. So I was wondering if that kind of restrains the ICRC's actions and programming
in certain areas. Yeah, great. So on the first part of your question about non-state armed groups, I mean, that's another striking statistic, but you probably all know this, that in the last 10 years, the number of armed groups worldwide fighting in armed conflicts went from 60 to 600. Okay, so it's been a dramatic change in the landscape that I should have mentioned earlier. We probably have contact at the moment with probably 450 armed groups. Okay, so, you know, we are entitled in the Geneva Conventions. I always feel I should bring the books. I'm kind of long and dull, so I don't. We're entitled to offer our services to all parties to conflict. Okay, so we will always tell a government, we're in touch now with seven armed groups in your areas, or we're talking to this enemy group or whatever, but we will have contact with them. And we take that very seriously. We have a very good armed groups team run out of Geneva, which is then spread out all over the world. We invest a lot of money in negotiating with all parties, having contact with all parties. Where, you know, being neutral is really expensive. I always remember Alex Duval saying this right way back in the 80s and 90s, that, you know, not everyone had the money to be neutral like the ICRC, and he's right now that I've sort of been inside it. We have to invest in hundreds and thousands of networkers across the world who are in constant touch with different armed groups, different governments in different places. And that aeroplane you saw in the film, taking children back to be reunited with their family, that aeroplane won't take off in a conflict area until all our networkers have got security guarantees from all parties that it's going to fly over. So we're constantly in touch and saying, right, we're going to fly this plane at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning, and it's taking this trajectory, and we need your guarantee you're not going to shoot it down. Okay? And you know it's coming, and this is what it is. It's an ICRC plane. Now, that takes a lot of investment to have all those relationships, but that's what we do. So we have a lot of contact with armed groups. We're doing a big piece of research on the moment on the quality of our dialogue with armed groups, because some of it's good and deep and, you know, sophisticated. Others is really just initial contact. So of those 450, we probably have very different qualities of dialogue with them. Your second question is directly related to that, about counter-terror legislation that's being imposed by the UN, by individual states, by others. We have worked really hard at the UN, my team in New York, the Security Council and others, to make sure that while states are rightly trying to ensure the protection of their populations and have counter-terror legislation, banning finance, banning all contact with terrorists, etc., labelling people terrorists, that they also realise that simultaneously the Geneva Conventions, international humanitarian law, say we are allowed to talk to anybody. Now, that is our big challenge all the time, and at the moment we've kept most counter-terrorism sort of clauses and legislation at bay. But it's a constant struggle. It's part of your struggle to push back and say... And we had an interesting case, because we're in the UK with the British government, I think I can tell you this, last year, when they said to us, look, you know, and they're our third biggest, but the US give us now 25% practically, and then the Germans have just taken over the Brits as the second, and then the Brits, then the EU. But the Brits said, we see you're giving lots of aid out to people in Syria, different parts of Syria. Could we see the lists of food, the people you're giving food to? And we said, no, absolutely not. And they said, but, you know, it's interesting to us because we're trying to work out, you know, who's giving food here and then who's giving food here. So we're looking at humanitarian coverage. And we said, no, absolutely not. We're never going to give you lists of people because we are independent and neutral. You pay us to use our humanitarian judgment to decide. And this went on, and then eventually we said, well, you can have your money back. So we gave them £10 million back and said we were simply not going to give them any lists. That's dealing with the Brits, but, you know, with other governments, it's a slightly more sledgehammer approach, and they'll just say, well, we're shutting you down, and that's it, and whatever.
So it's a very tricky question. Did that answer all your three? Everyone's asking three questions at a time. It's a really difficult.
So, so the not taking the threes approach is not working.
Yeah, exactly.
We need to innovate and cut them off.
Good.
Please.
Yes. Thank you for the presentation. So my question is more on, because you said you're negotiating access with governments, and I was wondering if you negotiate something broader on the implementation of humanitarian law, or is it mainly about access? And how does it relate with the neutrality principle and maybe the political side of it? And also, it's related, but also, what's the relation between ICRC and human rights law, if there is one, like if there is a conflict or no?
That's the second question.
Yeah.
It's good. Fine.
Legal question.
Yeah. Okay. So, and the first question was.
About like if you negotiate only access.
Oh yes, no. So no, we have a great arms team as well. We spend we've got so many lawyers at the ICRC. I never want to see another lawyer now. I've spent my last 5 years, you know, working with this huge building full of lawyers, and then we have lawyers all around the world, and it's great because they are all brilliant at the Geneva Conventions, at IHL, at all the other parts of IHL, and working hard to make sure that all states are respecting it and developing it. So, for example, I mean, the main areas of development of IHL at the moment, I mean, one of them would be around these new weapons. And we're arguing very strongly that new norms and laws and policies around IHL should be put in place around autonomous weapons, cyber warfare or whatever. So the ICRC promotes IHL, the laws of war, but we're also mandated to help states develop it. So a lot of our legal contact, our legal dialogue with states is actually working with them, trying to encourage them, look, you've got this new problem. We need to think legally how we work on that with you. And when you go back to the Geneva Conventions, it's always been the ICRC inviting states to Geneva to negotiate it. So a lot of our diplomacy is legal work. The second question about the relationship between, everyone know when I say IHL, International Humanitarian Law, the Geneva Conventions, Hague Conventions, other things about the laws of war. I think it's a terrible phrase, IHL, actually. Because the laws of war, you know, everyone knows what that means. When you say International Humanitarian Law, what the hell that means? Anyway, the laws of war are specific for armed conflict. We work a lot with human rights law because in a lot of the places we're working, as Henry was sort of implying, there may not be an armed conflict at that moment. So we may still be working in prisons. You know, most of the prisons we work in, and we see about 1 million prisoners a year, they're not always prisoners of war. They might be high security detainees in different places. And we also realized a few years ago that if we're working in a prison, we can't just work on the conditions for 1% or 2% of prisoners who are security detainees. We have to work across the whole prison. And there we would use human rights law. In urban violence, where the law of war does not apply, it's not recognized as an armed conflict, we would use human rights law. So we'll be working on the right to life, the legitimate use of armed force, all those kind of things. Yeah. So we use international human rights law a lot, and in our work. There's books about the relationship between the two. But
your question, and then I'll come to you.
Yeah.
So your profile mentions the work that you've done on the Palestinian territory.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if you could speak to that personal experience, and then maybe specifically the extent to which the Israeli blockade in Gaza and maybe the local leadership.
So, I mean, I've worked on and off on Israeli-Palestinian issues. I think I first went in, when would it be? In the first Intifada, I worked for Save the Children in West Bank and Gaza, so that must have been like 1991, a long time ago. Never permanently, but on and off from London. And then I've worked on it several other times in different ways. In terms of ICRC's work there, it's the place we've been longer than any other place because we've been there since 1947, 1948. You know, the other day I went to a Palestinian camp in Lebanon, I've forgotten its name, I'm afraid, which is the oldest Palestinian camp in Lebanon. And we have been in there since 1947 in different ways, and we're still there. So the blockade is very difficult for us, as it is for everyone, but it's much more difficult for Palestinian people, obviously. We have a long and you know, elaborate relationship with the Israeli forces and the Israeli government, and we are able to get those things we need into Gaza particularly. And a lot of that is water. Most of our work in Gaza, a lot of our work is on infrastructure and trying to maintain water, sanitation, sewage, electricity supplies for people in Gaza. So that works reasonably well. With the Palestinian authorities, it can be equally difficult sometimes. You know, sometimes it works well. It's always the same. You know, at a professional level, we're probably working very well with authorities who are running water, electricity, whatever. But if you asked us about our work in detention or on other issues of the use of armed force in the Palestinian territories, we would probably say that that's more of a struggle. And that is as hard there as it is in many other places. Yeah. Does that answer?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. In the middle of
the back. Development and humanitarian organizations are often criticized in terms of aid crowds out the local infrastructure. Do you think, can you think of an example when the Red Cross has ever faced that? Has ever had any adverse effects on the countries that it's been working in?
Yeah, there must be loads. There must be a lot. I mean, the point you make is absolutely true, that you get, you know, when you get this expeditionary model of international aid arriving, it displaces a lot of local initiatives, a lot of local talent. One of the worst things it does, and that's why the conversation we had earlier about the need for the localization agenda, is that we steal a lot of staff from government, from local community groups, because we pay more. Okay. So we contribute to a sort of brain drain from government and national authorities into sort of international aid land space. That's one chronic thing. Now, the Red Cross, the Red Crescent movement potentially could be one of the better ones there, because we always have a national society, we always have national volunteers, so there are already always lots of Red Crescent, Red Cross volunteers on the ground who are part of the community. So if we're working well with them, we're probably not displacing and reshaping the local welfare economy in a different way. In terms of your bigger question, you know, are there examples of where what we've done has had negative effects? I mean, there must be. There must have been places we put in water because we thought we should, which actually was damaging in some way. Or hospitals that we've run. I mean, one challenging thing we've done for many years now is, you saw it there, prosthesis. So people who get blown up or walk on a landmine, we'll make new legs, new arms. We're getting increasingly sophisticated at that. But it's meant we've ended up with lots of ICRC hospitals around the world which do this all the time. And they're not sustainable within the local economy and the local health system anyway. So we've ended up running these things for decades. And maybe at the beginning, if we'd worked with a different model, we might now have a much more integrated, better network of prosthesis. But I'm not thinking very clearly tonight of examples, but I would never sit here and say to you, aid never has negative effects, because it must do, constantly. But you should research them and find out, because you're at LSE, and I'm not.
So, recalling the part in the video clip we saw where it was a reference to the risk that ICRC staff members willingly take on by their participation in operations, particularly in conflict. I guess a question I find interesting is understanding that with this trend in professionalization in the humanitarian sector, that organizations are increasingly trying to deal with this sense of liability and liability to protecting staff members. And you see different manifestations of that. One side of a continuum being risk mitigation and security management. In some ways, this can even present itself as bunkerization or really kind of embedding down in security procedures. And in other ways, it might be more risk acceptance or risk sharing with the community. However, that does incur significant more, what I would assume would be liability costs to the organization. So I wonder, within ICRC's current situation, where they might
prefer to place themselves on that continuum of how they protect and how staff members might accept and take on risk, and then moving forward to where you might see the ICRC going in the future, particularly towards localization, how do you mitigate the possibility of unequal risk transfer to national staff members?
So that's a great question. It actually is a very good summary of the sort of security dilemma, you know, that people write books about. You're Risa Faust and all those other people who write books about this stuff. I think our view as ICRC, I hope we would put ourselves on the more risk-prone end of the spectrum. And when we all join, we sign a bit of paper which says we agree that we accept that if we are taken hostage or killed, that's part of the job, and we sign that. And what the ICRC will say in that is that if we are taken hostage, you know, they will never pay money for us, but they will always do their utmost for our safe return. And that's generally what happens. But it's understood we take that risk ourselves and we sign that document. The same with death. So I think we're on that end spectrum. I think our idea of due diligence for staff takes two main forms. The fact that we take security so seriously and we are actively seeking security guarantees from all parties to conflict all the time, and we're in touch with most parties to conflict all the time. So in a sense, we can reassure our employees that if they're going to work for an agency, this might be the one that's doing more to ensure security guarantees than many others. I think we try very hard. I mean, your phrase bunkerization, I mean, I was rereading Mark Duffield's new book and all that stuff, so I do relate to that very strongly because it's very different to when I started. I mean, the cottage industry phase was not bunkerized. The whole point was to be out and about, and we weren't put in these places with big security checks and barbed wire everywhere. We just weren't. That's definitely happening. And it definitely happens at certain points of ICRC infrastructure. But the whole culture is still to get out and not to stay in. And I think our security regulations are much more flexible and risk-prone than UN security system. And we are still running a system that is not centrally managed, like the UN one, which has whatever they call that department of...
UNDSS.
Yeah, DSS, who are the security experts that go around and dictate what should happen in different places. We don't have that. It's still local discretion. So it's at the discretion of the head of sub-delegation, head of delegation, or whatever. That's where security responsibility lies. So I think we are slightly different. In terms of passing on risk to national staff, I mean, you know the figures. They are awful. The majority of aid workers killed are Somalis, Yemenis, Iraqis, Afghans, Congolese, Nigerians. You know, the minority are international staff. I think that's probably a volume issue. There's more of them. You know, we would be very pragmatic and decide, you know, is it more dangerous for a sort of international staff member to go on that convoy or a national staff, which is better? And we'll try and play it according to context. I hope we're not transferring risk. But the reality is that most of our really good people, most of the people doing that networking I talk about, are nationals who know everybody. Mm. Yeah.
No one who hasn't spoken has a question yet. Let's come back.
I've got a far less academic question.
You've got a what?
A far less academic question.
Okay.
Since this is your last time speaking kind of on the part of the ICRC, I was wondering if there is a moment in your time working there that you feel great pride in, or something you like to reflect on that you might want to share with us during your years working at the ICRC, drawing it to a close. Now, as you come to the end of it?
Well, that's a lovely question. Thanks. What would I think? I suppose, you know, the moment that gives you most satisfaction is when you see the work really happening. So, you know, I in South Sudan, I went on one of those flights where we were taking wounded people back from our war surge, our field hospital, to their communities, and we were flying over the conflict and that sort of thing. And that was really you know, a great moment that we've saw this happening in action, and we took people back, having, you know, saved their lives on the operating table, got them back into where they came from. I suppose the second one that I found very moving personally for me is, you know, the first time you stand up for the ICRC and you represent it and speak for them at a major UN conference, or you write a statement for the UN Security Council or whatever, and you put the words together and you deliver that speech. That's very powerful too, because everyone, you know, in the diplomatic community, everybody knows us. And one of the loveliest things about being ICRC, if you're in one of those huge multilateral negotiating arenas, you know, where all the states have their names in front of them, and they're all sitting there like this, arguing over something or other. And what's really wonderful about being the ICRC, you just have this on, and then you just go to Iran and you say, hi, everybody, how's it going? What's going on? You know, blah, blah, chat, chat, chat. Then you go to Israel, they're always just virtually next to each other because of the alphabet, and you sit down with them, and then you go to America, and then you walk over and talk to the Syrians, because nobody talks to the Syrians, and then you go and talk to the Russians, and then you go and talk to the, and you can just go all around that room, and everybody knows who you are, and they're happy to see you, and no other party is going, why is ICRC talking to them? You know, it's just totally normal. That's the best bit about it. The other most moving bit, you know, because I think I find prisons terribly hard places, you know. They always say in the ICRC that the people that are most upset at the end of a piece of work are the people that have been working in prisons and places of detention. And what happens there, and I've only done this once with the ICRC, I did it in a prison in Bamako, yeah, in Mali. Am I right? Yeah. Thanks. And I went into a huge prison. And so when you're an ICRC delegate, you put on your ICRC flat thing, you know, you go into the prison, and then the guards open the cell doors, let you in, and then they lock you back in. They lock you in with all the prisoners. And so I sat for 2 hours in a room not much bigger than this. Let's say it's sort of half as big again, maybe double the size, probably with 400 men in it, young men, mostly young men, all really young men. And that was where they lived. And they sleep in shifts, okay? So they can't all lie down at the same time. So some of them stand round the walls while the others lie down, and then they shift. And this problem of prison overcrowding, you see, we don't see it because it's never on TV, but in a sense, the epidemic of imprisonment and detention around the world today, and the terrible conditions of people just locked up and there forever, it's really sad. And we can do certain things to improve conditions. We can get the food better. We can make sure there's immediate primary health care on site. We can get the water better. Sometimes we can stop torture. Sometimes we can encourage jury process so that people actually have their cases brought to justice, because most of them are just there and they'll say to you, what happened? I came, I was arrested. Nothing's happened to me ever since, you know. And it's really awful. And when you're locked in with people like that, you begin to have a slight feeling. And there's always a moment when you think, God, I hope they come back. You know, I hope they come back with the key. So that's very, and that's a really hard part of what the ICRC sees. And yeah.
Maybe to end on a kind of, bring it back to the beginning, I wonder if, and maybe there are some things that you would say to that because of that kind of visceral experience. What in your work you speak a lot about practicing humanity and humanity as a virtue, and that being a sort of the core really of it all. So I wonder if you could just summarize what you mean by that, by the idea of humanity as a kind of the animating virtue that should guide humanitarianism.
Well, I think it is about meeting people. And it's about meeting people truly as equals, in a spirit of equality. So it's you really see the person in front of you. And you don't play any great role, and there's no egotism in your role or what you're performing, you know, in all your gender studies, performative theory, all that stuff. You just have to go and be a human being with another human being. And I think when people see that that's what you're doing, you get a connection very quickly. They trust you very quickly. And they see that this person is not kind of bringing any dramatic sense of their own persona. They're not promising more than they can give. They're not trying to show power and hierarchy over a victim or whatever. And you just meet them as two human beings. And it's quite hard to describe, but it is really about being truly equal with everybody you meet. It's the most important thing you can be, I think, is to really believe that we are equal. And try and find each other. And find each other in that moment. Talking about prisons again, there's a wonderful article by one of our doctors who retired last year, a man called Paul Bouvier, who had worked for so many years on detention. And he wrote a wonderful article about small things, I think it is, in small things in humanitarian action. And he gave example after example how it was the small things that connected two human beings together and made them really appreciate each other and made a solid relationship. And I think that's the secret, just be human with one another. Don't pretend to anything else, really. And then you have to really get going and trying to make their situation better. So having done that, you then have to go and really work with the system, the authorities, the structures, to bring about change in some way. And sometimes you do, and sometimes you don't.
Thank you so much. That was incredibly inspiring.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. The speaker was Dr. Hugo Slim, and we were talking about war and humanitarian action. The wonderful music is by Ashley Lyle-Marsing. For more info on the Grimshaw Club and the Beaver Sound, just check out our website.